Good morning and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. What you should know about the pro-vegan Netflix film What the Health by Alexandra Sifferlin. The recent pro-vegan Netflix documentary What the Health is under fire from nutrition experts. The film, which is co-directed by Kip Anderson and Keegan Kuhn, the directors of another Netflix documentary, Cowspiracy, and co-produced by actor Joaquin Phoenix, is being criticized by some health professionals for exaggerating weak data and misrepresenting science to promote a diet that avoids all animal foods. Time fact-checked the film. Here are four things that What the Health got wrong and what it got right. No, eggs are not as bad for you as cigarettes. The documentary claims that eating an egg a day is as bad for your life expectancy as smoking 5 cigarettes a day due to artery plaque buildup from high cholesterol content in eggs. But that assertion is based on outdated information, and recent research suggests that the effects of eggs are nowhere near comparable to those of cigarettes. Recently, national nutrition experts declared that cholesterol found in foods such as eggs is not considered a nutrient of concern for overconsumption. Other research has shown that the kind of cholesterol you eat isn't solidly linked to cholesterol levels in the blood. Plant-based food can help decrease the risks for certain cancers, says dietitian Andy Bilotti, who has followed a vegan diet for 6 years. The idea that if you're going to eat an egg, you might as well smoke a Marlboro, I don't find accurate. The link between meat and cancer comes with caveats. Anderson, co-director of the film, rightly points out that processed meat was declared a carcinogen by the International Agency for Research on Cancer, IARC, a World Health Organization group, in 2015. IARC did find a link between eating processed meat and a higher risk for colorectal cancer. However, in contrast to the film, IARC did not suggest that eating processed meat is on par with smoking cigarettes. Instead, IARC maintains that eating processed meat and smoking bear different levels of risk. Processed meat has been classified in the same category as causes of cancer, such as tobacco smoking and asbestos, but this does not mean that they are all equally dangerous, the agency wrote in an explanation of its findings in 2015. According to the World Health Organization, about 34,000 cancer deaths per year worldwide are attributable to diets high in processed meat, while about 1 million cancer deaths are due to tobacco smoking, 600,000 are due to alcohol consumption, and more than 200,000 per year are due to air pollution. Sugar is, in fact, linked to poor health. In the film, several nutrition experts downplay the role of sugar in health problems and instead shift the focus to animal protein, despite the fact that plenty of research has linked sugar to diabetes and heart disease. Several reports have also suggested that the sugar industry funded research that turned attention away from sugar's link to heart disease, as well as research that has influenced national health recommendations related to sugar consumption and cavity prevention. I am of the belief that there are many issues with the American diet, and we can say that one of the issues is the high intake of added sugar, says Bilotti. I was dismayed that people were saying sugar is not the problem. Milk's link to cancer is weak. What the Health highlights studies that find links between people who drink milk and a higher risk of cancer, as Vox News points out, but there have also been plenty of studies in prominent journals that have not found a link between dairy and certain kinds of cancer. In moderation, dairy can be a part of a healthy diet because it's high in nutrients like protein and calcium. What the film gets right. What the Health underlines several aspects of the American food system that are often criticized, including the amount of antibiotics used in agriculture, which is linked to a growing health issue like antibiotic resistance. The documentary also highlights the financial relationships between food industry companies and national public health groups. Anderson points out that companies like Kraft, Danone, Oscar Mayer, and more, which sell processed foods high in fat, sodium, or sugar, like mac and cheese, hot dogs, and flavored yogurt, are sponsors of the American Diabetes Association and may have a financial stake in diet recommendations by health groups. Conflicts of interest between nutrition groups and food companies are nothing new. National nutrition guidelines are subject to lots of lobbying from the food industry, a common complaint among nutrition experts, including Bilotti, who argue that the government is giving too much weight to industry interests when forming dietary recommendations for Americans. It's important for Americans to know that many health organizations receive funding from companies and trade groups that are not in line with health, Bilotti says, and how that affects recommendations. Blythe Danner, How Scott Pruitt is Putting Our Kids and Grandchildren in Danger, by Blythe Danner. I'm a mother of two and a grandmother of four. What we all want for our families is for them to live and thrive in a safe environment. But Scott Pruitt, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, is putting that in danger with his destructive agenda. What's at risk? Basic essentials like the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat. Nothing terrifies and angers me more than to know someone is willing to put the interests of fossil fuel and chemical companies over the health and safety of my family. But I'm not going to sit by and let it happen. Sadly, Pruitt has the power to alter myriad of different regulations, but for the sake of urgency, I would like to discuss an issue that's near to my heart, the future of harmful pesticides and herbicides in our food and soil. Activists have long called on the EPA to ban a pesticide used at about 40,000 farms to grow broccoli, cranberries, and other foods. It's called chlorpyrifos, and it's been making news for its suspect role in the collapse of pollinator populations and its effects on endangered species. But perhaps most damningly, a number of studies have found that the pesticide can affect children's cognitive function when their mother is exposed to the chemical during pregnancy. Last year, the EPA's chemical safety experts concluded that the pesticide should be banned entirely after a scientific review of its harmful effects. But guess who decided to ignore the science and risks? Our quote-unquote head of the EPA, Pruitt, who said the EPA wouldn't ban the pesticide in March. By reversing the previous administration's steps to ban one of the most widely used pesticides in the world, we are returning to using sound science in decision-making rather than predetermined results, he said in a statement at the time. But what Pruitt failed to mention was that he had met with the chief executive officer of Dow Chemical, which produces the pesticide, just a few weeks before announcing his decision, as the Associated Press reported in June. An EPA spokesperson denied in April that Pruitt had ever met with Dow Chemical on the matter, but either way, the company is already embedded in the White House. Its chief executive heads President Donald Trump's American Manufacturing Council, and the company has been lobbying the Trump administration to stop looking into its harmful effects. Another harmful chemical Pruitt will get to have a say on? Glyphosate, an herbicide manufactured by Monsanto that's the key ingredient in commercial weed killer Roundup. Almost a pound of the pesticide is used on every acre of cropland in the U.S., according to Bloomberg. After researchers at the World Health Organization deemed it a probable human carcinogen, over 800 signed on to a class action lawsuit claiming the pesticide gave them cancer. Last fall, EPA officials said it probably doesn't cause cancer. Monsanto agrees, and of course, they've long been lobbying the EPA to stop looking into it. But we need to understand how these chemicals will impact human health. These toxins are poisoning our children and ourselves right now. Why are they allowed to be used to grow the food our children and grandchildren consume? How can we take such a risk when there are non-toxic options available? We can't let a decision like the one on chlorpyrifos happen again. Under the law, pesticides must be reviewed by the EPA at least one time every 15 years. Glyphosate is currently undergoing its review, and it gravely concerns me that this decision will ultimately be up to Pruitt. Even though California recently added glyphosate to its list of known carcinogens, it's unlikely Pruitt will do the right thing and label the pesticide as unsafe. Now, critics may argue that the EPA released a report saying glyphosate, which nonprofits Food Democracy Now! And the Detox Project found in Cheerios, Ritz crackers, and other mainstream snacks, is safe. Let's talk about this. Monsanto is about as big of a business as you can get, and it has millions to spend on lobbying to end research that may hurt its bottom line. How can we trust the Office of Pesticide Programs when they depend on data from herbicide and pesticide manufacturers to make decisions? Not to mention nearly 30% of the EPA's operating budget. And there are accusations that an EPA official helped Monsanto kill the office's study on whether glyphosate caused cancer. Monsanto denies the allegations, and the EPA has declined to comment on because of litigation on the matter. Can we really trust the same people making tremendous profits from these pesticides and herbicides to release honest and transparent data? It's not a risk I'm willing to take. After all, we did that long enough with the cigarette industry, and just look at how that turned out. Having the choice to buy organic food is not enough. What about families that can't afford organic food? I've spent my adult life fighting for environmental justice and the health of families. I can say unequivocally that a ban on these dangerous chemicals is the only option that will keep our kids and grandchildren safe for years to come. Please use your voice and send a message via email, social media, phone calls, or peaceful protest urging Scott Pruitt to ban glyphosate and other harmful pesticides and herbicides. Be persistent and loud. It's the only way to protect our families and our environment's future. Contact Scott Pruitt and the EPA by phone at 202-564-4700 or write to the Environmental Protection Agency at the Office of the Administrator, 1101A, 1200 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20460. Blythe Danner is an Emmy and Tony-winning actor and a board member of the Environmental Media Association. Five Things You Didn't Know About America's Millionaires by The Money Staff. As the ranks of America's millionaires continue to grow, the question for many becomes, how can I join the club? For a billionaire entrepreneur like Mark Cuban, joining the three-comma club was about discipline and investing in himself. You've got to have discipline in how you spend your money, Cuban told Money in an interview. You also have to be a little bit of a risk taker or invest in your education, whatever it may be, to help you get to the point where you can truly save money. A look at the data may provide some other helpful clues for anyone focused on building wealth. The majority of millionaires have their money in a very ordinary set of investments, not hedge funds and small businesses, but stocks, bonds, and cash. Keep listening for a snapshot of who America's millionaires are, where they live, what they do, and where their money goes. Maryland is the state with the highest percentage of millionaires. After a dip in 2008, the number of America's millionaires has increased steadily every 2 years, reaching over 10 million in 2016. Western and northeastern states tend to have the greatest concentrations of millionaires. The greatest chunk of millionaires' wealth is in stocks. The rest of their wealth is spread out broadly among bonds, cash, their primary residences, and other assets. America's millionaires are mostly white, largely male, and tend to be married. They also tend to be well-educated, with 83% holding at least a bachelor's degree. Statistically, the top-earning professions for millionaires are professional services, education, and medical or health fields. Growing Up in the Recession Strengthened My Career by Taylor Altman. I came of age during the Great Recession. After graduating from Stanford in 2006 and earning an MFA from Boston University in 2007, I believed that I could do anything I wanted. That quickly changed when I arrived in Las Vegas, where my mom had moved a few years earlier from New York. I didn't know it at the time, but the economy was on the verge of collapse and the job market was quickly drying up. In September 2007, I drove around Vegas applying for jobs at supermarkets and clothing stores, dropping my resume into black holes. I managed to land a part-time teaching gig at a community college, but even with four classes a semester, I'd make only about $10,000 a year. To supplement my income, I got a job as a bookseller at Borders at $7.25 an hour. An older friend from Boston asked me why my email sounded so bitter. "You didn't come out of college only to have your degree turn into a useless piece of paper," I wanted to write back. As an English major, I'd received no career counseling. "Do what you love," was the mantra of the day. I saw myself becoming a book editor or university professor with ease. Because I possessed a degree from Stanford, I imagined that someone would come calling and offer me my dream job. Nothing, of course, could have been further from the truth. I blamed my college for coddling me, leaving me unprepared for the bleak economic reality that awaited me beyond the campus green. And I blamed myself for overestimating my fitness for the real world, for being so naive. I'd pictured cheerily and industriously working in an office not unlike the seminar rooms where I received my education, not shelving books and ringing up purchases at a cash register. Whenever I started feeling sorry for myself, I thought of Jason, who worked with me at Borders. Jason had a wife and three kids to support. He worked at the bookstore by day and was up again before dawn for the breakfast shift at a bagel shop. He slept 3 or 4 hours a night, and I watched as the pressure wore down his body. Unlike him, I had only myself to worry about, and I knew that someday I'd work somewhere else. And yet I couldn't seem to escape the quicksand of my low-paying job. The longer I stayed, the more demoralized and unmotivated I became. Then, a year in, the stock market crashed. My mom was laid off from the airline where she'd been a flight attendant for close to 40 years. The community college could offer me only one course to teach the following semester. Borders was in serious financial trouble. Stressed co-workers snapped at the customers, and one even put his fist through the break room wall. Rage simmered everywhere. Rage over low wages, lack of job mobility, a sense that things would never get better. Everywhere I looked, people were pissed off. I was forced to consider what I might do if I lost both my jobs. My academic record alone wasn't going to help me get my foot in the door at a company. I'd learned that lesson. I realized I'd have to market myself, and as someone who suffers from social anxiety, that terrified me. Landing a new position would require, without any sort of guidance, turning my activities list, which still contained high school extracurriculars like field hockey and leadership council, into a one-page professional-looking resume. I'd need to encapsulate my goals and skills in a tagline on LinkedIn and present myself in the best possible light online. Hardest of all, I'd have to survive job interviews. I needed to learn how to answer questions like, "What is your biggest weakness?" in a way that sounded both self-assured and humble. I had to get comfortable with small talk and awkward pauses. I tried to train myself to sweat only under my arms so my palms would remain dry for handshakes and to lower my voice at the ends of sentences so I wouldn't be accused of upspeak. On one of my first phone interviews, I was asked about my desired salary. I replied, "Oh, I don't care what you pay me. I just really want the job." I had to learn to negotiate. In the future, I'd be sure to provide a salary range, if not an exact figure, based on careful research of similar positions. After months of searching, I found a position at a nonprofit and was soon on my way back to California. A few years later, armed with the skills the economy had forced me to acquire, I entered Berkeley Law School. There, while working at a consumer justice clinic, I saw the effects of the recession. Lost jobs and homes, massive credit card debt, ruined health, and I decided to pursue securities law to learn how the crisis happened and what could be done from a regulatory standpoint to prevent it from repeating. In a way, I'm glad I came of age in a time of economic distress. The recession shaped how I looked at my career path and the world in general. Things that were once so important to me, like striving for straight A's, suddenly seemed frivolous. I could no longer hide behind a computer screen or a book, feeling satisfied to exist in my own bubble. Nor did I want to. And education is just the beginning. It's how you use it that counts. Taylor Altman is a civil litigation attorney practicing in the securities, employment, and maritime industries in San Francisco.
White supremacists loved President Trump's latest comments on Charlottesville by Katie Riley. President Donald Trump's latest remarks about the clashes in Charlottesville, Virginia, drew praise on Tuesday from white supremacists after Trump said both sides were to blame for the violence. Thank you, President Trump, for your honesty and courage to tell the truth about hashtag Charlottesville and condemn the leftist terrorists in BLM Antifa. Former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke wrote on Twitter. Trump on Tuesday described anti-racism protesters as the alt-left and said, "There's blame on both sides. You had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent, and nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now," Trump said Tuesday in a press conference at Trump Tower. On Monday, Trump condemned white supremacists and called racism evil. But that response, which came nearly 48 hours after the violence in Charlottesville, was dismissed by many white supremacists. "He sounded like a Sunday school teacher. I just don't take him seriously," white nationalist Richard Spencer told reporters on Monday, according to HuffPost. "It sounded so hollow and vapid." Spencer praised Trump's comments on Tuesday. "Trump's statement was fair and down to earth. Hashtag Charlottesville could have been peaceful if police did its job," Spencer said on Twitter, adding, "I'm proud of him for speaking the truth." Eli Mosley, one of the organizers of the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, told a HuffPost reporter that he felt Trump's remarks showed he was supporting them. "The madman President Trump was on the campaign has returned. He has returned and he is out. He is going on offense. Everybody knows it. Everybody knows how the information environment just changed," said alt-right activist Jack Posobiec, known for promoting the false Pizzagate conspiracy theory. Take a bow, President Trump, because you just earned it." Trump's remarks, meanwhile, quickly drew criticism from both Republicans and Democrats. "We must be clear, white supremacy is repulsive," Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan said on Twitter. "This bigotry is counter to all this country stands for. There can be no moral ambiguity." A Confederate statue is gone, but the fight remains in Durham. By Nash Jenkins. There are more than 230 memorials to the Civil War in North Carolina, and just before lunchtime on Tuesday, an elderly man in a cowboy hat stood at the foot of what remained of one of them in Durham. "I don't care how you feel about what is going on," bellowed the man, who would give his name only as Gary. "I refuse to allow socialists and rabble-rousers to come in here and vandalize this town." Some passers-by wondered if it was a stunt. Gary is African-American, and the statue he was defending, which had been pulled from its pedestal by protesters 18 hours earlier, honored the memory of Confederate soldiers who fought for enslavement and murder and the right to hold slaves, as Ron Barron, a bearded Duke University mathematics professor who stood nearby, chided him. "That didn't go over well either." "You're ignorant," retorted another passerby who cradled his toddler son and wore a black T-shirt with a Confederate flag advertising the Sons of Confederate Veterans, retorted in a thick Eastern Carolina drawl. "The Civil War was about states' rights. You can spout your false narrative all you want. You do not know what you're talking about." It was a tense day in Durham. After a white nationalist protest over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia, about 3 hours north, turned violent, leaving one woman dead, a group of Bull City activists gathered by a statue of a young Confederate soldier outside the former courthouse. Using a thick yellow cord, they uprooted the statue. Video of the moment went viral on Twitter, and one protester, a 22-year-old student at the historically black North Carolina Central University, now faces felony charges. The protesters argued they were forced to take the law into their own hands. Under a state law passed not long after white supremacist Dylann Roof shot and killed 9 African-American worshipers at a church in Charleston, South Carolina, local governments cannot remove or modify historical monuments, including those that commemorate the Confederacy. "We won't accept memorials to people who held slaves," said Barron, who had participated in the Durham protest. "If the city won't do it, if the state won't do it, then the people will do it." Local officials weren't exactly rushing to condemn the vandalism. "People are outraged," Durham Mayor Bill Bell said. Bell, the city's longest-serving mayor and the second African-American to hold that office, sounded tired. "The tearing down of the statue represents the frustrations of the people in attendance last night, given the climate in this country and specifically what happened in Charlottesville." Durham is not alone in the state in being divided. In recent years, the state's urban centers in Raleigh and Charlotte have become more populous and more cosmopolitan, setting up a tension with the more conservative areas in the rest of the state. In 2016, the 7 most populous counties went for Hillary Clinton, while 76 of the remaining 93 were won by Trump. That tension played out in a contentious fight over state legislation in 2016 that aimed to restrict which bathrooms transgender people could use. The fight over statues will likely prove another flashpoint. Democratic Governor Roy Cooper said in a statement Tuesday that he hopes to remove the remaining Confederate monuments, saying that "we cannot continue to glorify a war against the United States of America fought in the defense of slavery." But for now, the restrictions on removing memorials remain in place, and the Republican-led legislature would have to agree to change that law. In Durham, local leaders weren't eager to put the statue back up either. "We don't know what our options are legally," Durham County Commissioner Brenda A. Howerton told me over the phone. "I'm not speaking for the rest of my fellow commissioners, but personally and politically, I'm not interested in using the taxpayers' dollar to put it back up." How President Trump Failed His Biggest Leadership Test Yet, by Zeke J. Miller. For 7 months, President Donald Trump giddily has ignored the norms of his office and tried the patience of those who had more than a passing knowledge of its history. But during Tuesday's press conference, before the gold-plated bank of elevators inside his Midtown temple to himself, the president defended those linked to white nationalists, neo-Nazis, and other racist corners of American society in a display that defied any historical precedent. So striking was his bold protection of a small but vocal part of his political base, many reporters in the marble foyer dared to interrupt the president. If he was breaking with custom, so too would they. If you look, there were people protesting very quietly the taking down of the statue of Robert E. Lee, Trump said of the Friday night march around the University of Virginia campus. That torch-lit procession featured white nationalists chanting, "Blood and soil and Jews will not replace us." Presidents can make war, but the truest test of a commander-in-chief is his power to heal. Standing on burning rubble in Lower Manhattan, or visiting a mosque a few days later, addressing an auditorium to memorialize those killed in coal mines or by a gunman in an elementary school classroom, a president's words have the capacity to console a nation in grief, settle its collective fears, and call its people to action. That was the task before Trump as he spoke for the third time since the events in Charlottesville. His first brief remarks, in which he blamed many sides for the violence, were heavily criticized. In heavily scripted remarks on Monday, he said all the right words, though he seemed to resent the effort. And finally, at home in Manhattan for the first time since he became president, Trump cut loose. Still smarting from Monday's forced statement condemning neo-Nazis, Klansmen, and white supremacists, Trump shoved a finger into the gaping wound of race relations in America. The president repeated his assertion that there is blame on both sides of the violence. Pressed, the president refused to yield and went even further. "You had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent, and nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now," he said, his voice echoing in the chasm of a lobby. You had a group on the other side that came charging in without a permit, and they were very, very violent." Nearby, John Kelly, his newly minted chief of staff, brought on to calm Trump's id, hung his head. If the president was looking to win praise from both sides, he failed. For the second time in a week, a bipartisan parade of lawmakers lined up to scold the president. The loudest cheerleader of his statement was none other than David Duke, saying this was what the president truly felt in his heart. Others on the alt-right, racist and bigoted fringes of the Republican Party cheered, even as its elders watched, yet again, as their brand went into yet another tailspin of Trump's making. The press conference followed a presidential statement on infrastructure where aides had hoped he would not take questions. But Trump, still frustrated by critics in both parties who condemned his tepid response to the unrest Saturday, came ready to brawl. In his breast pocket, he carried a copy of his initial remarks. "We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence," Trump read, leaving off his phrase that provoked so much consternation hours after a white supremacist allegedly rammed his car into a group of counter-demonstrators on many sides. Explaining his delayed condemnation of racist groups, Trump said he was waiting for more information at the time. "When I make a statement, I like to be correct. I want the facts," he said. Republicans throughout Washington chortled at that, given Trump's years of planting false seeds that President Obama was born in Kenya, that millions of people voted illegally during the last election, and any number of incomplete statements about his own campaign's interactions with Russian officials. Yet the motivation of those fighting in the Virginia streets was clear as day, and Trump's own fidelity to the facts appears increasingly to be a unicolor endeavor. His administration has rushed to condemn terror attacks and acts of violence perpetrated by racial and religious minorities, but have slow-walked those in which they are victimized. He still has not commented on an August 5th attack on a mosque in Minnesota. It was not without merit to note that the counter-protesters turned violent as well, but in painting with such a broad brush, Trump suggested moral equivalency between those preaching racial supremacy and those upholding the national ideals of pluralism. "You're changing history, you're changing culture," Trump said of those looking to remove town statues of Confederate generals and slave owners, some to museums where more context about their place in history could be explored. Trump mockingly suggested that George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, founders and slaveholders alike, would be next. In doing so, he washed over the painful debate spanning the country over the competing virtues of reckoning and acceptance. It was a sobering reminder of the forces that propelled Donald Trump to the White House in a campaign rooted on exploiting fears and feelings of dislocation, but also a sign of how, in the end, it was still about Trump. As he walked away from the cameras, Trump, who acknowledged he had yet to speak with the family of the woman killed Saturday, Heather Heyer, was asked if he intends to visit Charlottesville soon. "Do you know I own a house in Charlottesville?" he responded to reporters. "I own actually one of the largest wineries in the United States. That's in Charlottesville."
Obama's response to the Charlottesville violence is the most liked tweet of all time. By Helen Regan. Former President Barack Obama's Twitter response to the deadly violence in Charlottesville, Virginia over the weekend is officially the most liked tweet ever. Obama posted a series of tweets Saturday quoting former South African President Nelson Mandela in the wake of clashes between white supremacists and neo-Nazis and protesters. "No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin or his background or his religion," the first tweet read. "People must learn to hate, and if they learn to hate, they can be taught to love. For love comes more naturally to the human heart than its opposite," he continued. The initial tweet, which was accompanied by a photo of the former president smiling at four children in a window, was liked 2.73 million times and retweeted more than 1.1 million times as of late Tuesday. At Barack Obama. "No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin or his background or his religion." Twitter confirmed to Time that the post became the most liked tweet in the company's history, and it's the fifth most tweeted ever. Obama's tweet surpasses Ariana Grande's response to the Manchester terrorist attack in which 22 people were killed after attending her concert in May. President Trump has come under fire from all sides of the political divide for being slow to condemn racists and hate groups by name after a white supremacist plowed his car into a crowd of protesters, killing 32-year-old Heather Heyer. On Tuesday, Trump reiterated his original comments, saying that many sides were to blame for the violence. Daniel Craig confirms that he will return as James Bond. By Alexia Fernandez. Rejoice, James Bond fans. Daniel Craig is returning as 007. The 49-year-old actor confirmed the news while on Tuesday's The Late Show, telling Stephen Colbert, yes, point blank. I always wanted to. I wanted a break, Craig continued, referring to the iconic character that launched him into stardom. Earlier Tuesday, Craig told Boston radio program Morning Magic 106.7 that no decision has been made at the moment. There's a lot of noise out there, and nothing official has been confirmed, and I'm not, like, holding out for more money or doing anything like that, Craig said. It's just all very personal decisions to be made at the moment. I know they're desperate to get going, and I would, in theory, love to do it too, but there's no decision just yet. Craig expressed reluctance to reprise his role when promoting Spectre in 2015, admitting he couldn't think about a new Bond film at the time. Now, I'd rather break this glass and slash my wrist, he told Time Out. No, not at the moment. Not at all. That's fine. I'm over it at the moment. We're done. All I want to do is move on. In 2015, he told the Red Bulletin he was still thinking about returning and said, being away from his family, he's married to Oscar winner Rachel Weisz and has one daughter from a previous relationship, while Weisz has a son, while filming had taken a toll. Yes, it's always the same question. Which is worse, leaving the party too early or staying, getting totally drunk, and then passing out on the floor, he asked. I still don't know. What I need right now is to stop working, relax, and get back to normal life. There's nothing unusual about that, he continued. It's really horrible not seeing your family for weeks at a time. There's one thing I actually find more exciting than Bond at the moment. Going home.
Elvis Presley died 40 years ago. Here's why some people think he's still alive. By Melissa Chan. Elvis Presley, the legendary singer and movie star who became known as the King of Rock and Roll, died of heart failure 40 years ago this week. His death on August 16, 1977, stunned the music industry and devastated millions of fans worldwide. In the days following his funeral, speculation grew among a small group of skeptics that Elvis might not have died after all. Despite clear statements from doctors and a coroner that the 42-year-old superstar was dead, disbelievers were adamant that the gyrating beloved baritone had faked his own death to go into hiding. Over the past four decades, fans across North America have insisted they've spotted Presley out and about. In 1989, three so-called Elvis enthusiasts even created the Elvis Sighting Society to monitor these apparent incidents. Some people even claimed he appeared as an extra in the 1990 blockbuster Home Alone. Presley isn't the first famous figure our nostalgia-obsessed pop culture has been unable to fully let go. Conspiracy theories have cropped up after other high-profile deaths, from Hollywood star James Dean's demise in a car crash in 1955 to Michael Jackson's prescription drug death in 2009, as fans insist their favorite celebrities must still be alive. Here's what to know about the conspiracy theory surrounding Presley's death. Some believe Elvis was connected to the mafia. One of the biggest theories on why Presley may have faked his death is because he had to in order to escape the mafia. Gail Brewer Giorgio, the author of the 1988 best-selling book Is Elvis Alive, recalled in a recent interview with Time how she pored through thousands of FBI documents to come to the conclusion that Presley was an American hero who had to go into witness protection. Do I know if Elvis is alive today? No, I don't, she said, but I know he didn't die on August 16th. Brewer Giorgio, now 78, said the FBI enlisted Presley as an undercover agent in 1976 to help the agency infiltrate a criminal organization called the Fraternity, which was apparently made up of dozens of racketeers. Presley volunteered, spurred by his love of America and respect for the FBI, according to Brewer Giorgio. The author said the agency had approached Presley because a member of the fraternity had apparent dealings with Presley over the sale of an airplane the singer had. But when Presley was found to be a mole, he was put into the witness protection program, Brewer Giorgio said, citing what she said was evidence from FBI documents and interviews. Elvis faked his death because he was going to be killed, and there was no doubt about it, she said. The FBI did not immediately comment on the decades-old claim that Brewer Giorgio describes at length in her book. There's no mention of Presley aiding the FBI in the more than 760 files the federal agency has released that pertain to the singer between 1956 and 1980. The FBI never investigated Presley, but a folder in his name was created because he had been the target of several extortion attempts the FBI probed. The released documents outline the extortion cases, and they also show Presley's admiration for the FBI. During a tour Presley took of the FBI's headquarters in 1971, the musician spoke favorably of the Bureau and offered his services in any way, according to an FBI memo. There's also mention of Presley's plane and a business arrangement involving the aircraft. Elvis experts say the docket lacks evidence suggesting Presley is alive. Those FBI files are available to the public. I have them. There's nothing in there, said Patrick Lacey, an Elvis Presley researcher who wrote Elvis Decoded, which debunks the theory surrounding Presley's death. All of the evidence points to a death, the medical evidence, the eyewitness report, Lacey told Time. To have him have faked his death would have required the silence and the services of literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people over the years. Others point to Elvis's tombstone as evidence. Besides believed sightings, skeptics also point to what they insist are slip-ups from Presley's family in media interviews and an apparent name misspelling on the King's tombstone as proof of a cover-up. The skeptics say Presley's middle name was purposefully spelled wrong, A-A-R-O-N instead of A-R-O-N, on his tombstone because putting his real name would have been taboo since he was alive. Debunkers say that the King started spelling his middle name Aaron with two A's instead of one later in life. In a 2005 interview with Oprah on the TV host's show, Presley's wife Priscilla was addressing how Presley spoiled their daughter Lisa Marie. Skeptics believe Priscilla said, "It's exactly what he said the other day," before correcting herself and saying, "You said," to Oprah. They also say Lisa Marie evaded Larry King's question during a 2003 interview when the host asked if she ever feels communication with her father. The impact of the Elvis conspiracy theories. The conspiracy theories bring unnecessary pain to Presley's family, said Lacey, who calls himself a big Elvis fan. I didn't just get into this because I've got nothing better to do. I believe that the people who say Elvis is alive are doing a great disservice to him and his family, he said. Imagine you have to go through your life saying your father did all of these things and that he conned his fans. Elvis's death hurt a lot of people. It still does. You have to ask what kind of person would Elvis be to do something like that to his fans. A vast majority of Americans believe Presley did, in fact, die in 1977. A Gallup poll conducted in 1997 found only 4% of Americans thought Presley was alive, while 93% of those surveyed were certain he was dead. Still, Brewer Giorgio remains firm on her stance. The Georgia woman, who said she does not have a single Elvis album and owns no memorabilia of him, insists her findings are based on facts and not feelings. "I know what he really did," she said. "The world needs to know that Elvis Presley put his life on the line." "I think it's sad that we don't know the whole Elvis," she added. "If I don't do this for Elvis, nobody is going to."
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Time's The Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.